Finland and Sweden are now one step closer to joining NATO, with all 30 members of the alliance signing their accession protocol. The Bank of England warns that Britain's economic outlook is very uncertain, stressing that the Ukraine-Russia war could further disrupt global energy and food supplies. And for the first time in three decades, Germany registers a rare deficit in its monthly trade. Hello and welcome to World News. Thank you for joining us. NATO's 30 members signed an accession protocol for Finland and Sweden, taking a further step towards letting the Nordic states into the military alliance. Under the protocol, both countries can take part in the alliance's meetings and have more access to intelligence, but NATO will not defend them militarily until their membership is ratified. Speaking at a presser afterwards, NATO General Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg held the signing of the protocol as an historic moment and said the alliance will be stronger and safer with its new members. The two countries requested to join NATO after Russia launched its military operation in Ukraine in February. Russia has repeatedly announced its opposition to NATO's enlargement. Last week, President Putin said it's inevitable that Moscow's relations with Helsinki and Stockholm will sour once they join the US-led alliance. Our Brussels correspondent Jerome Hughes tells us more about the significance of Finland and Sweden joining NATO, and also how future political transitions could affect the process.
Well, you know, it could take much longer than a year, in fact. And don't forget, in the meantime, you have political transitions. So you could have a change of government in the current 30 members of NATO. And so obviously the landscape could change in terms of opposition to this move. But I mean, just once again, to quote, if you Pope Francis, for example, just to quote him, because he's seen as a moderate figure, he says that this conflict in Ukraine, it was provoked or it could have been prevented. And what you see is the expansion of NATO at all costs. You see an endless amount of money going into NATO. Don't forget, most of the countries that are in the EU are NATO members. The EU at the same time in parallel is forming its own army. So you have billions of euro going into a new EU army. At the same time, you had Donald Trump pushing for a minimum of 2% of GDP for NATO members to spend on military hardware. And you've got the likes of the UK now saying that they'll spend 2.5%. So you have this endless amount of money going into NATO. And this endless, as people would say it, if you listen to many analysts, they say this endless provocation of against Russia. There's just this build-up of NATO forces right along Russia's borders. And, you know, one of the red lines for Vladimir Putin was for Ukraine not to join NATO. It looks like that's not going to happen, of course, but it looks like Ukraine is going to join the EU. The EU will have a new army soon. They're already spending a fortune on that. So de facto, you know, Ukraine will be part of a major military force. And so really the end game here and the big question when you listen to analysts, when you speak to political scientists, when you speak to security experts, they're asking the question, where is this all going to end? At what point are we going to see World War III? Really, that's what people are saying.
The cost of living crisis coupled with rising inflation is taking a heavy toll on Britain's economy. A report now paints a darker picture of the country's economic situation. The report published by the Bank of England warns that the economic outlook for the UK and the rest of the world has deteriorated materially. It says the UK economy is very uncertain. The International Monetary Fund has already said that the Britain Isles is more susceptible to recession and persistently high inflation than other Western countries. British households have been paying more for energy, food and fuel in recent months, mainly due to the economic fallout of the Ukraine war. Prices in the UK rose at the fastest rate in 40 years in May, with inflation hitting 9.1% on an annual basis. Experts believe the inflation rate in Britain could surpass 11% this year. Germany posts a monthly trade deficit for the first time in three decades as the war in Ukraine takes its toll on European economies. The German Federal Statistics Office says more imports exceeded exports, by roughly $1 billion in May compared with April. The rare deficit is blamed on interrupted supply chains and record high energy prices. This is partially triggered by Russia's move to cut back natural gas supply to Europe. Germany relies on Russia for 35% of its natural gas, and Germany's Federation of Trade Unions has warned that the short supply can lead to the collapse of entire industries if it remains unresolved. Political commentator Steve Keen says the economic problems of European countries such as Germany stem from imposition of sanctions on Russia.
German industry depends upon energy it has to import from overseas, particularly Russian now, of course. And with both the war and the attempt to sanction Russia, where they've pointedly left energy out of that sanctioning, it's reduced the quantitative impact, but it's driven the price up extremely high. And it shows largely that Germany's success depends upon continuing cheap energy. And that is something which, of course, is not going to continue as we go forward with declining supplies of conventional fossil fuel energy and not sufficient amount of either nuclear or renewables. The sanctions specifically exempted energy imports. And that just shows how completely dependent Europe is upon Russian energy. And what economists don't understand is the absolutely essential role that energy plays in production. One of my favorite lines is that capital without energy is a sculpture, and labor without energy is a corpse. You have to have energy inputs to both to produce output. And this has been neglected by economists and neglected by Germany's managers as well. So because they're so dependent upon Russian energy, they simply can't afford to boycott it.
A senior Ukrainian official reports massive Russian shelling of Slovyansk, a city in the eastern Donbas region, which has become a new battleground. The Slovyansk mayor says the city's center and its north are being targeted constantly by the Russian military. Local police says one person has been killed and three others wounded so far. Ukrainian authorities have already asked residents to leave the city. Russian forces captured the neighboring Luhansk province over the weekend, which was personally held by President Vladimir Putin. Together, Luhansk and Donetsk from the Donbas region, which has witnessed a deadly conflict between the Ukrainian military and pro-Russian groups since 2014. In other news, the British government has approved WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange's extradition to the United States. Assange is wanted over the publication of America's classified military documents and diplomatic cables that had exposed crimes committed in Afghanistan and Iraq. Now, the Mexican president has criticized Assange's extradition, becoming the only international figure to do so. We further discuss the matter in our news review program.
Mexico's president says the Statue of Liberty would no longer be a symbol of freedom and should be dismantled if the U.S. gives a death sentence to WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange. López Obrador, who has offered asylum to Assange, says that he would call on the U.S. president to drop the charges against him. Obrador added that the Australian whistleblower has been treated unfairly and worse than a criminal. Assange is facing extradition from Britain to the U.S., where he is charged with publishing classified military and diplomatic documents. The WikiLeaks founder has appealed the British court ruling on his extradition. Fraud Hughes is an author and journalist joining us from Belfast, and Greg Simmons is an author and researcher joining us from Kuldīga in Latvia. Welcome to you both. Fraud Hughes, if only other officials would come out standing for Julian Assange the way that this Mexican president has. First of all, why do you think the Mexican president has had a keen interest in this? And do you agree with the statement that he has made that the Statue of Liberty should be taken down?
Absolutely. I very much welcome the intervention by the president of Mexico. I think in some respects he's trying to redress the balance when we remember that it was the Ecuadorians that initially gave asylum to Julian Assange and its embassy in London. And then once there was a change of president there, and Ecuador needed $4 billion bailout from the IMF and from the American banking infrastructure. Part of that deal, I believe, was to hand over Julian Assange. So when you contrast the humanitarian efforts of the president of Mexico with the Prime Minister of Australia, who was recently elected. In opposition, he claimed that he wanted Julian Assange to be released. And now that he has been elected, he is refusing publicly to call for the release of the Australian citizen Julian Assange. So I think you can compare that also along with the treatment of Bradley Manning, now Chelsea Manning. He, stroke she, originally gave the 50,000 emails to Julian Assange and WikiLeaks. And in 2017, Obama commuted her sentence and released Chelsea Manning from prison. Yet it was the same presidential regime, to include Joe Biden, who began the extradition process against Julian Assange in 2014. So three different leaders of three different countries acting in complete contrast to each other, but the only person who is trying to defend freedom of the press and the right of the press to hold power to account is the president of Mexico.
Indeed. Okay, let's take a listen to some of the online posts as shared on social media, and we'll get right back to both of you. First post, they need to make an example out of Julian. He became too much of a threat to the war machine. Assange utilized technology in exactly the way that it should be utilized to serve humanity as a whole with WikiLeaks. It was a serious threat to power, so the power structure responded. Next post, Julian Assange is still in prison. His abusers, the U.S. war criminals funding the Ukraine war, have still not been held to account. Time to stand up for Australia and justice. Next, you can't support both press freedom and the torture of award-winning journalist Julian Assange. It's an either-or scenario. And a final post, why hasn't the European Court not banned the politically motivated extradition of Julian Assange? A decent, honest man plagued by the totally justice from the UK and the US courts. Ultimately, one of the things, obviously, that this case has shown is how much information is hidden. And, of course, you have what they call whistleblowers, Greg Simmons, like Julian Assange, in terms of WikiLeaks, of what it revealed to the public. And, of course, they don't want that to happen. But do you think that, the way this has resonated with many is going to not stop people who are within the establishment, one way or another, of releasing information that they find to be of harm in terms of whatever it is that the government is involved in, whether it's foreign policy or what have you?
Well, I mean, this is what they're trying to prevent, whistleblowers, by creating this very abusive action, which, I mean, is completely not according to the law, I mean, which is why they call themselves a rules-based order now. But this is to prevent those cases, Assange, Snowden, Manning, from recurring, because it's an embarrassment for these ones who are abusing their position of power. And this can have one of a couple of effects. Sure, it can deter some people, but in other cases, it might bring up some kind of moral compunction to actually put an end to these examples by exposing them for what they are.
Okay, thank you so much for that. Greg Simmons, author and researcher. Thank you, Fra Hughes, author and journalist from Belfast. Thank you both. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of the News Review. Thanks for tuning in.
Moving on to other news, the Karish gas field in the eastern Mediterranean remains at the heart of dispute between Lebanon and Israel. The Hezbollah resistance movement says its recent flying of three drones towards the field was a warning to the regime not to carry out any extraction operations before the dispute is resolved. The movement added that the drones launched at the weekend accomplished their reconnaissance missions. It said the move was also aimed at reinforcing Lebanon's stance in indirect negotiations with the Zionist regime regarding demarcation of areas in the disputed region. Hezbollah and high-ranking Lebanese officials say Israel's operations in the Karish gas field are an effort to plunder Lebanon's offshore natural resources. Lebanon has also dismissed Israel's claims that the field falls within the regime's so-called exclusive economic zone. Now to China, where a spike in COVID cases puts some regions on alert, prompting them to announce restrictions. Local authorities in Xi'an City, central China, say that seven-day lockdown measures will be implemented to curb the new outbreak. Since Saturday, Xi'an has recorded 18 new COVID cases driven by Omicron variants of the virus. Another lockdown is set to start on Tuesday for over 1.7 million people in eastern Anhui province. Nearly 300 COVID infections were reported there on Monday. That's just days after China relaxed some COVID-related restrictions for overseas travelers for the first time in over 2 years. Thousands more people are ordered to leave their homes in New South Wales, Australia, as torrential rains keep battering the country's east coast. Over 50,000 residents, mostly in Sydney's western suburbs, have been told to either evacuate or warned they might receive evacuation orders. This comes amid the risk of flash floods as rivers in the area rise past the danger level. The federal government has declared the flooding a natural disaster. Things are worsened by winds of up to 90 kilometers an hour in several flood-hit areas, raising the risk of falling trees and power lines. Moving to Italy, they have declared a state of emergency in the north amid the worst drought in 70 years. The government says it has earmarked emergency funds for the affected population in the agricultural river Po Valley. The region produces around 40% of the country's food. Italy's largest agricultural union says the drought is also threatening half of the country's livestock. The dry season is caused by early summer heat wave and a lack of rainfall. It has forced cities in northern Italy to impose restrictions, including on the use of water. That brings us to the end of this news bulletin. Thanks for tuning in.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The US government's Indo-Pacific Strategy Report 2019 claims that China uses economic inducements and penalties to persuade other countries to comply with its Belt and Road Initiative. We now present you an article written by Vijay Prashad, an Indian historian, editor and journalist. The piece is titled U.S. Makes Another Stab at Challenging China's Belt and Road Initiative. The article was published by the Asia Times. At the Group of Seven summit in Germany on 26th of June, U.S. President Joe Biden made a pledge to raise $200 billion within the United States for global infrastructure spending. It was made clear that this new G7 project, the Partnership for Global Infrastructure and Investment, or PGII, was intended to counter the Chinese Belt and Road Initiative, BRI. Given Joe Biden's failure to pass the Build Back Better bill, with its scope being almost halved from $3.5 trillion to $2.2 trillion, it is unlikely that he will get the U.S. Congress to go along with this new endeavor. The Partnership for Global Infrastructure and Investment is not the first attempt by the U.S. to match Chinese infrastructure investment globally, which initially took place bilaterally and then, after 2013, happened through the Belt and Road Initiative. In 2004, as the U.S. war on Iraq unfolded, the U.S. government set up a body called the Millennium Challenge Corporation, which it called an independent U.S. Foreign Assistance Agency. Before that, most U.S. government development lending was done through the United States Agency for International Development, or USAID, which was set up in 1961 as part of President John F. Kennedy's administration's campaign against the Soviet Union and against the Bandung spirit of non-alignment in the newly assertive Third World. Former President George W. Bush said U.S. aid was too bureaucratic, and so the Millennium Challenge Corporation would be a project that would include both the U.S. government and the private sector. The word corporation in the title is deliberate. Each of the heads of the Millennium Challenge Corporation, from Paul Applegarth to Alice Albright, has belonged to the private sector. The current head, Albright, is the daughter of the late U.S. Secretary of State, Madeleine Albright. The word challenge in the Millennium Challenge Corporation refers to the fact that the grants are only approved if the countries can show that they meet 20 policy performance indicators, ranging from civil liberties to inflation rates. These indicators ensure that the countries seeking the grants adhere to the conventional new liberal framework. There are also great inconsistencies among these indicators. For instance, the countries must have a high immunization rate monitored by the World Health Organization, WHO, but at the same time they must follow the International Monetary Fund's requirements for a tight fiscal policy. This in essence means the public health spending of a candidate country should be kept low, resulting in the required number of public health workers not being available for the immunization programs. As a U.S. government official told me in 2022, the U.S. Congress provided $650 million to the Millennium Challenge Corporation. For its first year in 2004, the amount sought was more than $900 million. In 2007, when former U.S. President George W. Bush met with Nambarin Enkhbayar, the former president of Mongolia, to sign a Millennium Challenge Corporation grant, he claimed the Millennium Challenge account, which is administered by the Millennium Challenge Corporation, is an important part of our foreign policy. It's an opportunity for the United States and other taxpayers to help countries that fight corruption, that support market-based economies, and that invest in the health and education of their people. Clearly, the Millennium Challenge Corporation is an instrument of U.S. foreign policy, but its aim seems to be not so much to tackle the sustainable development goals of the United Nations on hunger, health and education, as George W. Bush claimed, but to ensure extension of the reach of U.S. influence and to inculcate the habits and structures of U.S.-led globalization or market-based economies. 2009, then-US President Barack Obama developed a pivot to Asia, a new foreign policy orientation that had the US establishment focus more attention on East and South Asia. As part of this pivot in 2011, the then-Secretary of State Hillary Clinton gave an important speech in Chennai, India, where she spoke about the creation of a new Silk Road initiative. Hillary Clinton argued that the US government, under Barack Obama's pivot to Asia policy, was going to develop an economic agenda that ran from the Central Asian countries to South India, and would thereby help integrate the Central Asian republics into a US project, and break the ties the region had formed with Russia and China. The impetus for a new Silk Road was to find a way to use this development as an instrument to purportedly undermine the Taliban operations in Afghanistan. This US project foundered because of lack of congressional funding and because of its sheer impossibility, since Afghanistan, which was at the heart of this road project, could not be persuaded to submit to US interests. Just 2 years later, in 2013, the Chinese government inaugurated the Silk Road Economic Belt Project, which is now known as the Belt and Road Initiative. Rather than go from north to south, the Belt and Road Initiative went from east to west, linking China to Central Asia and then outward to South Asia, West Asia, Europe, Africa, and beyond. The aim of this project was to bring together the Eurasian Economic Community, established in 2000, and the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, which was set up in 2001, to work on this new, bigger project. Roughly $4 trillion has been invested since 2013 in a range of projects by the Belt and Road Initiative and its associated funding mechanisms, including the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank and the Silk Road Fund. The investments were paid for by grants from Chinese institutions and through debt incurred by the projects at rates that are competitive with those of Western infrastructure lending programs. The US government's Indo-Pacific Strategy Report 2019 claims that China uses economic inducements and penalties to persuade other countries to comply with its agenda. The report provides no evidence, though, and indeed scholars who have looked into these matters do not see any such evidence. US Admiral Philip Davidson, who previously commanded the Indo-Pacific Command, claimed in Congress that China was leveraging its economic instrument of power in Asia. The Millennium Challenge Corporation and other instruments, including a new International Development Finance Corporation, were hastily set up to give America an edge over China in a US-driven contest over the creation of infrastructure investment globally. There is no doubt that the Millennium Challenge Corporation is part of a broad Indo-Pacific strategy of the United States to undermine Chinese influence in Asia. Only a handful of countries have thus far received MCC grants, starting with Honduras and with Madagascar. These are often not very large grants, although US officials claimed for a country the size of Malawi or Jordan, they can have a considerable impact. No large countries have been drawn into the Millennium Challenge Corporation's compact, which suggests that the United States wants to give these grants to mainly smaller countries to strengthen their ties with the United States. Nepal's accession to the Millennium Challenge Corporation must be seen in this broader context, although the discovery of uranium in Nepal's Upper Mustang region in 2014 seems to play an important role in the pressure campaign on that country. In May of 2017, Nepal's government signed a Belt and Road Initiative Framework Agreement, which included a plan to build a railway link between China and Nepal through the Himalayas. The rail link would allow Nepal to lessen its reliance on Indian land routes for trade purposes. Various projects began to be discussed and feasibility studies were commissioned under the Belt and Road Initiative plan. These projects, more details for which emerged in 2019, were the extension of an electricity transmission line and the creation of a technical university in Nepal, and of course, construction of a vast network of roads and rail, which included the Trans-Himalayan Railway from Keirung to Kathmandu. During this time, the United States entered the picture with a full-scale effort to disparage the Belt and Road Initiative funding in Nepal and to promote the use of Millennium Challenge Corporation's money there instead. Under U.S. pressure in September of 2017, the government of Nepal signed an agreement with the United States called the Nepal Compact. This agreement, worth $500 million, is for an electricity transmission project and for a road maintenance project. After both deals had been signed, a political dispute broke out in Nepal, which resulted in the split of the Communist Party of Nepal and the fall of the leftist government. One major issue on the table was the Millennium Challenge Corporation and its role in the overall Indo-Pacific strategy of the United States, which seems to be targeted against China.
Ocean of Dua.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين Hello everyone, brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi with you with another edition of the program, The Ocean of Dua. In this edition of the program, we'll have a glance at Kumail's supplication and we'll discuss a commentary on that. We'll be back in a few seconds, so stay tuned.
Ya man bada'a khalqi wa dhikri wa tarbiyati wa birri wa taghdiyati habni libtida'i karamak wa salifi birrika bi ya ilahi wa sayyidi wa rabbi أتراك معذبي بنارك بعد توحيدك وبعد من طوى علي قلبي من معرفتك ولهج به لساني من ذكرك واعتقده ضميري من حبك وبعد صدق اعترافي ودعائي خاضعا لربوبيتك.
Brothers and sisters, we have reached this excerpt of the Kumail supplication. هيهات أنت أكرم من أن تضيع من ربيته. Far be it from you. You are more generous than that. You will not torture him whom you have nurtured. أو تبعد من أدنيته. You will not banish him whom you have brought up. You will not drive away him you have given an abode. أو تشرد من أويته. You are not going to submit him to tribulation whom you have spared and shown mercy. أو تسلم إلى البلاء من كفيته ورحمته. This part is a kind of manifestation of the divine mercies. From the very beginning of creation of humankind until his death, the Almighty puts him under two kinds of training, material and spiritual. The kind of material training is fulfilled by a wide variety of blessings. Human beings use all different blessings, either by their own will such as the blessings of eating, drinking, breathing, etc., or unintentionally by Allah's will, such as mechanisms for absorbing the chemicals in human body, such as providing all the body organs with these necessary materials. How these materials from the fruits, from the foods, are being attracted to the body? How are they absorbed? Human beings are not consciously aware of that, but it is being done. And this is only one aspect of the blessings we're not aware of. And this is what is mentioned in the different verses of the Holy Quran. We'll be back with one instance of it after a short break.
Oh my God, my Master, my Lord, and my Nourisher, will you see me punished with the fire kindled by you, despite my belief in your unity? And despite the fact that my heart has been filled with knowledge of you, and when my tongue has repeatedly praised you, and my conscience has acknowledged your love, and despite my sincere confessions and my humble begging submissively made to your divinity, no, indeed you are far too kind and generous to destroy one you nourished and supported, or to drive away from yourself one you have kept under your protection.
Thank you, Allah, God let me hear, feeling so good about all the things that we went through, knowing that God is pleased with us too. It's not a dream, this is so true, and we know we'll be here forever. The feeling is indescribable, knowing that this is our reward.
The ocean of dua.
So we said that different trainings are happening in the world, material and spiritual training. And material training is fulfilled by different blessings of the Almighty Allah. Sometimes they're intentional, sometimes they're unintentional. And this is what is briefly mentioned in chapter Yunus of the Holy Quran. This verse of chapter Yunus says, قُلْ مَنْ يَرْزُقُكُمْ مِنَ السَّمَاءِ وَالْأَرْضِ. Say, who gives you sustenance from the heaven and the earth? أَمَّنْ يَمْلِكُ السَّمْعَ وَالْأَبْصَارِ. Or who controls the hearing and the sight? وَمَنْ يُخْرِجُ الْحَيَّ مِنَ الْمَيِّتِ وَيُخْرِجُ الْمَيِّتَ مِنَ الْحَيِّ. And who brings forth the living from the dead and brings forth the dead from the living? وَمَنْ يُدَبِّرُ الْأَمْرِ. Who regulates the affairs? فَسَيَقُولُونَ اللَّهِ. Then they will say Allah. فَقُلْ أَفَلَا تَتَّقُونَ. Say then, will you not then guard against evil? So the blessings of the Lord in our lives are different. We are, for example, unable to analyze even a single organ of the body. We cannot understand all its details. We are not able to appreciate only one organ of our body as a blessing, let alone all the body organs and their order, their interrelationships, as well as their relations to outer factors. This is the kind of Lord that we have to appreciate. Allah the Exalted reveals His love to His servants by showering upon them His blessings so that they might love Him. Indeed, the bounties showered upon the heedful and intelligent hearts are only effective in endearing Allah to them. This is a very interesting point, since in his famous supplication at dawn, Imam Zainul Abidin alayhi salam says, O Allah, you show your love toward us through your bounties, and we return you with sins. The good from you constantly descends upon us, while the evil from us ascends to you. The honored angel has always been and is still bringing you the news of our ugly deeds, But that has not prevented you from continuing to embrace us with your blessings and to kindly provide us with your bounties. Glory be to you. How clement are you, and how great you are, and how kind you are as the beginner of the creation and the eventual claimer of it. Because the true way of thanking Almighty Allah for these blessings is to use them all in their order, in what the Almighty Allah and the infallible Imams, the Prophets, have recommended us to do. So overall, we're unable to imagine what is going on in the wonderful system of creation, and our bodies, one of them. In the next episode, we will, God willing, mention only one aspect of the wonderful system of human body, just in order to imagine the greatness of Almighty Allah's mercy. Thank you, brothers and sisters, for staying with us in this episode. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parstoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
I need you by my side. I wish to be close to you through all my life. Ya Allah, oh Allah, be with me.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
Following its unpardonable crime of 3rd July 1988, the U.S. has resorted to the most heinous measures against the Islamic Republic of Iran, such as increased support for the MKO hypocrites, a vast variety of endless sanctions, politicization of Iran's peaceful nuclear program, assisting the Israeli regime to assassinate Iranian scientists, and launching the drone attack that martyred General Qasem Soleimani at Baghdad Airport on January 3, 2020, while on a diplomatic mission to Iraq. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Kayhan, international staff writer. This article is published under the heading Flight 655, Irrefutable Proof of U.S. Terrorism. Stay tuned for more. Flowers floated once again in the Persian Gulf waters near Hengam Island in the Strait of Hormuz on Sunday, July 3rd, as bereaved family members of martyrs of Iran Air Flight 655 joined by Iran's coast guards and related officials paid tributes to the souls of their loved ones who were criminally killed by the super terrorists called the United States of America. It is now 34 years since the dastardly downing of the Airbus A300 with 290 passengers, including 66 children on board by the USS Vincennes, which had deliberately entered Iran's coastal waters for shooting down the 4 days a week scheduled flight from Bandar Abbas to Dubai. This crime against humanity of the great Satan was meant to lift the sagging morale of the Ba'athist war machine on the battlefields of the 8-year imposed war, with a green signal to Saddam of the repressive minority regime of Baghdad to continue to batter Iranian combatants, as well civilians, with internationally banned chemical weapons. It was also the Yankee way of sadistically celebrating the July 4th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence in 1776 of the 13 rebellious New England states. Captain William C. Rogers, who carried out this cowardly act of terrorism, was under direct orders from President Ronald Reagan to wreak vengeance upon Iran for the Islamic Revolution that ended American hegemony and inspired the Iranian people to blunt and push back the U.S.-supported Ba'athist invasion. He was later decorated for this unmanly act as further proof of devilish nature of the Republican and Democrat regimes that play musical chairs at the White House. The downing of Flight 655 was thus neither the first act of U.S. state terrorism against Iran, nor will it be the last, given the unstoppable progress of the Islamic Republic in all fields, including science and technology, along with the spirit of resistance infused by Iran into the elected governments and popular movements of the region and beyond to defeat the designs of the Makarali murderous Takfiris, the Zionists, the imperialists, and the reactionaries. The U.S., which along with Britain had instigated the 1953 coup to overthrow the democratically elected government in Tehran and then for 26 years held the nation hostage, has never ceased its plots against Iran and the Iranian people. Following its unpardonable crime of July 3, 1988, the U.S. has resorted to the most heinous measures against the Islamic Republic, such as increased support for the MKO hypocrites, a vast variety of endless sanctions, politicization of Iran's peaceful nuclear program, assisting the Zionist regime to assassinate Iranian scientists, and launching the drone attack that martyred General Qasem Soleimani at Baghdad airport on January 3, 2020, while on a diplomatic mission to Iraq. Washington, however, has miserably failed in its misadventures, as is evidenced by the tooth-smashing blows it has received and will continue to receive until the last American intruder is kicked out from the entire region and, God willing, the illegal Zionist entity ceases to exist. Examples gather in this regard, such as Iran's sophisticated cyber tactics in forced landing of the highly advanced U.S. RQ-170 drone on December 5th, 2011, the spectacular downing of the radar-evading RQ-4A Global Hawk surveillance drone on June 20, 2019, with a Mach 5-speed surface-to-air missile, and the missile barrage that shattered the U.S. Ain al-Assad base in Iraq on January 8, 2020. The sacred blood of the martyrs, whether of Flight 655 or of General Qasem Soleimani, Dr. Mohsen Fakhrizadeh and others, is too dear to be left unpunished, as will be seen in the near future, no matter under what screens of security the criminals hide.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.